From the Xfinity Studios at WVON. You're listening to American Heroes, hosted by Cliff Carter on WVON AM 1690.
Chicago, 1690 WVON. I'm Cliff Kelly. This is America's Heroes Group, which is a radio talk show that has transitioned race, creed, and color through engaging, connecting, empowering, and transforming veterans, armed forces, and their family members by being the synergistic hub to veterans affairs, information, resources, and referrals. And I am so glad to be the host, Cliff Kelly. Glenda Smith is our executive producer. And we are so pleased to be sponsored by Attorney Steve Seidman of Seidman, Margulis, and Fairman, LLP, 20 South Clark Street, 2 First National Plaza, 700, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. Toll-free number is 888-873-3275. The office, 312-781-1977. Pearl's Place, Down Home Cooking, Southern Cooking, let me say that. 3901 South Michigan, Chicago, Illinois. Phone number 877-275-3852. America's Heroes Group. She serves, she matters. Partner and sponsor, National Women's Veterans United, NWVU. 8620 South Pulaski at the lower level, Chicago, Illinois, 60652. The office number 872-731-2150. Website www.nwvu.org. And America's Heroes Group is proudly sponsored by the Tuskegee Airmen, Inc., the Chicago Dodo Chapter. Ken Rapier is the president, 8035 Walcott Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60620. Phone number 773-879-2698. Tuskegee Airmen, which is just great. We are pleased to have some great guests on our live show. Let me remind everybody, leap year is today. It's February 29th, okay? Supposed to tell everybody that. And we always want to make sure we do that. With us on our live line, none other than our great person, Attorney Brian Clough, neutral arbitrator, mediator, and America's Heroes Group Advisory Board member. Counselor, how are you?
I am great, Cliff. Greetings from the Southwest. We are sitting here with Jen Oliva, and we are very close to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, so if you hear any loud noises while we're talking, it's the A-10s going off.
Wow. Where are you? Where is the Air Force Base?
Tucson.
Tucson. And the professor is with you.
Yes, she is. Jennifer, she's here in the office. She was kind enough to come in. As you see from her background.
Oh, my goodness. Woo.
Yeah.
Her background is unbelievable. Jennifer D'Oliva. Professor, thank you so much. She's an associate professor at Law, Seton Hall University School of Law, One Newark Center for Health and Pharmaceutical Law and Policy. But as the consular mentioned, Brian mentioned, when you look at her background, it's easier to say what she hasn't done than what she has done. Oh, my. How are you, Professor? How you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real honor and privilege.
Oh, listen, we are so pleased to have you. In reading about your background and all the things that you have done and continue to do, Professor, let me say this. She's United States Army veteran and, of course, admitted to the bar in Delaware, California, the District of Columbia, West Virginia. Also admitted to numerous United States District and Appellate Courts, including United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and the United States Supreme Court. What is obvious when I look at your background, all the things that you have done and continue to do, Professor, including Harvard Law School and the whole, if I kept talking about what you do, we wouldn't be able to say anything. So tell me, and Brian, help me with it. What do we need for Jennifer to say?
Well, one of the things that you'll find in her bio that's particularly interesting, I mean, she's a smart in pants. West Point, and while she was at West Point, she got voted a Rhodes and Truman Scholar, an Oxford Master, Georgetown Law School, but brings the experience of a vet that helps inform all the work she did. One of the most interesting things I thought she did from our perspective today, she ran a legal clinic at the University of West Virginia Law School. And we all know that West Virginia has certain challenges. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that she saw there, I believe, informs her work now. She's consulting on some National Institutes of Health projects. She's working on the intersection of medicine, public health policy, and legal policy. And that's what I brought her on for because she's not just an academic, not that there's anything wrong with that, but she's not sitting around all. She's been out there, both as a vet and both auxiliary, driving around her pickup truck in rural West Virginia, which is kind of a redundant term, and getting people into legal aid. And that's what I thought we might want to talk with her about, some of those challenges and some of the things we can talk about for your rural listeners and some of this insight Jen provides.
I would love that. Jennifer, Professor, would you go right ahead and tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so when I got to West Virginia University at the law school had a sort of very nascent, small outreach program to veterans, and I really wanted to build that out. And so we started inviting folks to come into the clinic and talk with students. So that we could make sure that they were getting the veterans the benefits that they were entitled to for their service. And I was telling Brian earlier, one of the challenges that was immediately apparent to me was because there had not been services or much outreach in the state into these rural populations, and because these individual veterans in West Virginia had maybe a contact or two with VA, and it had been a bad contact. It had not been helpful. We had to get past a really huge trust issue on the front end. So that was my big challenge, and Brian just surrounded. That's when I got into my white Ford F-150 and decided to drive out into these rural hollers in the 55 counties in West Virginia and talk to people on the ground. You have to make them believe that you know what you're doing and that they can trust you. And you have to win a couple cases so you can then get those veterans to turn around and talk to their friends. And by the time I finished there, we had more than 50 active cases going, and the clinic was extremely successful. So it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my entire career.
That is so interesting. And Professor, you were a cadet at United States Military Academy, correct?
Yes, I was far less successful at that than I was in representing veterans of West Virginia. But I did squeak out of there by a nose. Yes.
What did you do when you were, what was your MOS? What did you do when you were in the service?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was a military police officer and
wow, an MP.
That's right. I was an MP, so I was very popular with the other soldiers, as I'm sure you can imagine, well-loved. But that job really is what sort of incentivized me to go into health law, because we were often, you know, a lot of folks coming back from conflicts, PTSD, self-medicating, and, you know, the policing function is not well equipped to handle the complex issues that these folks had and developed because of the stressful environments that we were sending them into and the losses and the pain and suffering, physical and mental, that they were experiencing. So I thought, when I get done with this gig, I'm really going to look at health care and health law, because I think we're trying to pawn too much of this stuff off to police who don't have the sort of training ability, resources, or function to handle these complex issues.
Wow. We're always pleased to have, of course, Brian with us. And the professor, our call-in number here at America's Heroes Group is 312-374-8130. 312-374-8130. The places you have been, the professorships you have held, it's amazing you've been able to do all of that, and you're still doing it. What's your situation now, Professor?
Well, right now I am at Seton Hall University in New York, New Jersey. I was, as you mentioned, lucky to be in West Virginia for the first 3 years of my career. And I spent a lot of time practicing before that. But one of the real motivations for me to go and take an academic job was the freedom to be able to do this pro bono work for veterans. And one of the things I want your listeners to know is that an old rule that's on the books prevents veterans from having viable legal representation or paid for legal representation at the initial benefit stage of the proceedings. And I've written an article about this because it's really tragic, but Congress in 1853 passed a statute that said veterans, you can get a lawyer, but you can't pay them more than $5. And the reason that the Civil War statute was passed is folks thought lawyers are to be trusted. They'll steal from the veterans' claims. They'll take a huge percent. You know, take 33% of whatever the veteran gets. And they're very concerned about this. Well, folks lobbied in 1865 at the close of the Civil War. They doubled that amount to $10. And from 1865 until modern times, that statute stayed on the books at $10. So as I'm sure you can imagine, it's very difficult to hire a competent lawyer to represent you in a VA claim at the initial stage for $10. So you've got to do some of this stuff, or at least kickstart some of this stuff, with folks who are willing to do it pro bono. So if a university wants to pay me a salary and teach the students and says that the rest of your time you can spend trying to help these veterans out, that's a job I'm going to take.
You know, this is really something. And also, Professor, there's so much you've done and continue to do. You were appointed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Then you were subsequently appointed Deputy State Solicitor of the State of Delaware by then Attorney General Bo Biden. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a,
I bring you topical guests, Cliff.
Oh, that's something, right? Yeah. Well, it's just tremendous. So what to both of you, because, you know, Brian is with us all the time, Jennifer, what do we need to be looking at now with the things that are going on relative to our military?
Well, Cliff, I'm going to jump in for just a second and then ask the gender opine on this, but access to justice in rural communities, as I've talked about many times on your show, and your work, your listeners might be a little sick of hearing about, it's always been rough, but it's in crisis mode now. If you are living outside of a major metropolitan area, I think the legal term is that we use in the law, and you'll forgive me for using Latin, Cliff, mm-hmm. is you're screwed. Mm-hmm. So the work that Jen is doing on this intersection, if we look at medicine, public health policy, and law, I mean, Jen's doing work on opioid addiction. I mean, there's not, I dare say there's not a listener out there that does not know somebody whose family has been affected by addiction.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So where that's going, particularly in rural communities, is insight that I'd like to hear from Jen. So I'll throw it back to Jen.
Yeah, please. Jennifer?
Yeah, Cliff, thank you for letting me speak to this, because I do think it's important to point it out. There's a great book that was written by a couple of scholars a few years ago called Casualties of War. And one, they point out something really simple by doing a whole bunch of hard math and crunching numbers in their book. What they point out is that the folks who are more likely to serve, and then more likely to serve in the risky jobs, the front line, the tough infantry, those sorts of jobs, and then, of course, more likely to be injured or have sort of an emotional or physical disability leaving the service, are folks from poor zip codes. And most of those zip codes are in one or two places, certain parts of certain urban areas like the city of Chicago, and then the rest of them are filled out by the rural landscape of the United States of America. So certain neighborhoods in certain urban cities, and then predominantly rural after that. I thought that was very interesting because it's sort of, to Brian's point, we keep putting people, so then those folks were poorly resourced from the beginning. That's why they were likely to try to leave their home communities to make a better life for themselves and get training. We put them in the most difficult, most dangerous situation. Perhaps they're better off, perhaps they're worse off from a health perspective at the end of their service. And then they go back to a place that, again, was poorly resourced, where there's not a lot of access to either health care or justice. And it really bothers me that we can prove this empirically. This is not Leva's opinion. Okay? It's not Klaus's opinion. And it really bothers me that there's not more focus on this. It sort of seems like we keep punching down the same people who keep stepping up for the country. So that's the sort of cycle to build on what Brian said that I think it's important for the listeners to be aware of.
Amazing. I tell you, what you have done and continue to do, Professor, Counselor, whatever, is just it's amazing. Brian, give us an end to this, would you please?
Well, Cliff, I'm really appreciative that we have brains like Jen addressing these issues. And, you know, as much as we, you know, joke maybe about professors, and I mentioned in my comments, you know, professor, she's not just sitting in the office writing articles.
Right.
She was out there working. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad she is in the office writing articles and speaking to decision makers and informing policy decisions, because, you know, you and I have talked about this. Jen raises an important point, Cliff.
Right.
Urban America and rural America send their kids off to war at a higher percentage than any other parts of our society.
Counselor, thank you so much, Brian. You're great, and we'll be talking back to the professor soon. Brian, as always, thank you so much. We'll be back
thank
with
you,
more.
Coach.
You're welcome. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is the Talk of Chicago, America's Heroes Group. I'm Cliff Kelly. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Cliff Kelly, Vietnam veteran and host of America's Heroes Group, the game changer in radio, print, and digital media programming. We are a roundtable talk show where information, resources, and referrals are provided intentionally every Saturday to empower our military population on WVON 1690 AM, the iHeart Radio app from 4 to 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. Please visit our website at www.americashg.org.
Hi, this is Cliff Kelly, the host of America's Heroes Group. If you or a loved one has been injured in an accident or the result of malpractice, you have only one chance to get the compensation you deserve. You need a law firm you can trust with experience and resources who will fight on your behalf. With a proven track record of excellence both in and out of the courtroom, call Seidman, Margulis, and Fairman at 312-781-1977 for a free consultation, or visit SeidmanLaw.net. That's Seidman, SEIDMAN, www.cliffkellylaw.net.
Hi, we're the National Women Veterans United, the proud sponsors and partners of the Americans Hero Group.
Our mission is to ensure that women veterans are aware and have access to their VA benefits, resources, and entitlements. We monitor current or pending legislation that may impact VA eligibility and services. And we provide a safe place for women to come relax. We have a meditation room. They can get food, clothing, housewares, whatever emergency services they may need.
We're the only Women Veterans Center in the state of Illinois. We are members of the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard, National Guard, and the Reserves.
Hey, Cliff, where can a veteran business owner go on the south side of Chicago for breakfast, lunch, and dinner meetings?
I'm a veteran, and that's an easy answer. Pearl's Place on 39th and Michigan. Pearl's Place has free parking available across the street. Reasonably priced, quality food that tastes delicious. Veteran owners, there's no place like Pearl's Place.
Hi, I'm Cliff Kelly, Vietnam veteran and host of America's Heroes Group radio talk show. It's an honor to salute the bravery, sacrifice, and legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen, shoulders of excellence and resilience that helped to pave the way for all African-American soldiers, men and women, past and present, to serve.
Hi, I'm Sister Soldier, proud partner of She Voices on America's Heroes Group. She serves, she matters, where your change becomes empowered. Also, watch me on the web at SheVetInspires.com or YouTube. Remember, I'm every woman because I am just like you.
Hi, I'm Cliff Kelly, Vietnam veteran and host of America's Heroes Group radio talk show. Gerard Moore, you are a millennial, and I appreciate your support and appreciation for our veteran population.
Yes, Cliff, it's an honor for me to show my support and my appreciation always, especially during Black History Month. Thank you, veterans.
Chicago, 1690 WVON, and of course, this is America's Heroes Group. And right now, it is the Financially Speaking with Sean. And all of you know who Sean is. He's one of our regulars, Sean Claiborne, Vice President at Wayne Hummer Investments at Wintrust Wealth Management, National Guard veteran, and a roundtable public policy panelist on America's Heroes Group, and we're pleased to have him. Sean, how are you?
Pretty good. And good. I have to also make a note. So Wayne Hummer is now officially Wintrust Investments. So they changed the name to reflect the changing times and things of that nature. So,
okay,
yeah,
all right, very good. So what does that mean?
Well, it just means basically that, you know, we are a wealth management firm that specializes in offering services to people that understand the value of money, but sometimes maybe we don't know how to use it the way that we should or know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. So what my job is basically is working with families and small businesses to help them grow their assets, protect their assets, and become stronger financially responsible people.
And that means a lot, because what we really want to talk about, and of course Sean's been with us many – you people who've been listening and know, you know, he's been very helpful over the past. And, of course, veteran National Guard person, and has always been a roundtable public policy panelist on America's Heroes Group, so he's not a stranger to you. But what we want to discuss today, the hidden truth military families face relative to financial security. There's some major problems with how military families handle their money, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And that's one thing that a lot of people, the mainstream media and the mainstream public doesn't really realize is that they have this idea that when you join the military, you have this great job, you're going to have this great pay, and you have these great benefits, and all these great things are going to come your way. Mm-hmm. They're going to pay all your school tuition and all these great things, but they don't realize the hurdles and the boundaries that are actually in place to those benefits, and they're not necessarily all that what they are. People think they what they are, because here in today's world, especially with the new legislation that's been passed by the Trump administration, there's a new word we have to get used to, and the new word in our lexicon has to be food insecurity, because you have a lot of families in the military and also veterans on top of that that are actually facing hunger and also facing and using food stamps to get by. Mm-hmm. You know, so right now there's some new rules to the SNAP program where they're actually taking some of the benefits away from what they call able-bodied individuals. Now, on the surface, it sounds like a pretty decent, wholesome idea. The idea, according to the Trump administration and also Sonny Perdue, who's the head of the USDA, what they're basically trying to accomplish is, in their minds, there's 3 million people, able-bodied single people that are out there that are on food stamps that don't need to be on food stamps. And then there's also this stereotype myth of the person who's got food stamps, who's, you know, buying steak and lobster at the grocery store, who's riding around in a Cadillac and all these different things. There was a welfare queen that Ronald Reagan brought up back in the old days. But so it kind of plays to a stereotype and a myth that there's a lot of people out there that are on food stamps that don't really need it. Now, of course, there are people that are going to abuse a system, any system, and that exists anywhere. And we've all been approached by that guy at the Jewel late at night or at the Walmart late at night. Says, hey, I'll give you XYZ amount of dollars if I use my link card or my food stamp card or whatever. But that's not the majority of people that are on food stamps. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is that people don't realize is that when people join the military, if you look at the map of where a lot of high populations of people that are joining the military, they're in rural, used to be inner city, but now mostly rural southern states, in particular like Alabama, Mississippi, so on, where there's not a lot of job opportunities. There's not a lot of economic progress going on. The standard of living is a lot lower. Okay, so the military is a way for them to join to get a job and actually get some education to try to get out of those situations oftentimes. And for many people, it's a career. The problem is that when you join the military, your pay is not going to be the substantial pay that you think you're going to get. There's different types of allowances that people can get while they're in the military. For example, there's the basic allowance subsistence you can get for the military, where you can apply to get certain types of benefits to help you cope with the standard of living. When I was in the military, to give you an idea, I got $100 a month. I mean, I think the average pay for an E-2 private, something like maybe like $1,200 a month, roughly around that, roughly thereabouts right now. That's not a lot if you got a family of four that you're feeding with that. Mm-hmm. And if you get a lot of the allowances don't apply to your family. It applies only to you. So people don't realize when you get on post, you have a choice. You can eat at the chow hall and get the chow hall food, or you get, you know, basically a meal card. The meal card allows you to buy your food, but it's only about $300, $400 a month. $372 is actually the allowance for 2020. They actually buy food on post. That covers your on-post meals and your off-post meals. Only time that covers when you go into the field and you're getting MREs and things like that, and you're walking in the chow line or something like that in the field. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you get $372 a month for a basic enlisted soldier. You're getting about $256 a month if you're an officer. Okay, so if you have a family to think about on top of that, that's not a lot of money to actually feed a family. So that's why you see a lot of spouses on food stamps in the military. There's something like 23,000 families that are actually in the food stamp program across the country. And then if you're a spouse of a veteran or a spouse, I'm sorry, of a service member, a lot of times your deployments or your duty stations can change. So it's difficult for spouses to get jobs because you might be in a certain area for 6 months. You could be there for 6 years. You could be there for 2 years or 2 months. You have no idea how long you're going to be there. So it's hard to build a career to sustain yourself if you're married oftentimes to a service member. So now you're starting to see a trend even too that a lot of service members are marrying other service members. You're seeing that a lot in the military today. Mm. So
for that because they both get it.
Right. Yeah. And that, and also it's easier to, mm-hmm. you know, build a family with someone who understands and lives a lifestyle.
Right.
Because being in the military is a lifestyle. Now, a lot of the thing about this, too, that kind of troubles me a lot, Cliff, is the fact that we need to really start to take a step back and look at how the veteran family actually is put together and the challenges that they face every single day. It's sad to see that, and it's disparaging to understand that there's 23,000 families on food stamps that are in the military currently. It's also kind of sad to understand that there's 1.5 million roughly veterans that are taking food stamps. There's also, I mean, you have 36 million Americans on food stamps across the country. 1.5 of those are veterans. So the thing of it is that when you start to take that in consideration, look at what how the military is built and who's actually serving in the military, then you got to start realizing and start to understand, okay, we don't need to nickel and dime our military service members on benefits and let them have better benefits so they can get good housing, get their food and education and their housing under control, so that way they can be a more productive veterans, a more productive people when they leave the military. Because once you leave the military, then you still have a whole other set of challenges to try to transition from the military world to the civilian world. You know, so those types of things. So one thing people need to realize is that a couple of months ago, the people that are on food stamps already realize this, the standards have changed, and there's probably a lot more changes that are coming to the food stamp system. Originally, Trump was talking about trying to put work requirements in. We have to work 20 hours a week. You can only get on food stamps for 3 months out of the year, or 3 months out of every 3 years, actually, is what the proposal was. Some of those things haven't trickled in. A lot of those things have been voted down. You know, so now I'm not against the idea of the concept of if you're able to work, you should get a job.
Yeah,
I agree with that. Most people would agree with that.
Sure.
Okay, but it's more complicated than just saying, okay, this is what you got to do. Mm-hmm. If you don't have this or that or whatever, we're kicking you off food stamps, because you have to look at geography. One of the main things, and you'll appreciate this because you worked in government for many of your years, they're taking away the choice for the states to administer their own guidelines for the food stamp programs. So that's one of the major complaints about the policy is the fact that states used to be able to administer and have exemptions for certain people that could qualify. Now that's being taken away.
Who's taking that away, Sean?
The federal government. Department of Agriculture says now, okay, if you meet certain income requirements, so basically a family of four has to make $50,000 or less for a family of four in order to qualify for food stamps. If you can basically work, if you have less than so many hours of volunteering services and things like that, there's volunteer requirements you're trying to put into the idea. The problem with volunteering, so you say, okay, if you get a food stamp, you get food stamps, you have to volunteer so many hours a week or so many hours a month and so on, or work or go to school. But if you look at what people are getting, you're talking about the average of $156 a month, and you're volunteering 20 hours a week. Or working part-time 20 hours a week to get $156 worth of food stamps. The math does not add up. Who will take a job making $156 a month for 20 hours a week? You can make more money than that at McDonald's, okay? Now, and also in certain parts of the country, they're just not the job opportunities that are there that you have in certain other parts of the country. So to take the ability for the states to basically regulate and administer their own guidelines is a fallacy, because they understand their constituents, they understand their demographics, they understand their local challenges and things. Some places of the country might be unemployment rate might be 1%. Mm-hmm. You have other places of the country, other parts of the country, even certain areas of the country, unemployment rate could be 40%.
So what we see here, Sean, and you're an expert on this, reports have shown different numbers say some 1 in 4 military families are utilizing food banks. Others showcase that $21 million in SNAP benefits unreally accounted for.
Right. Right. So it's hard to really understand exactly how many people are on food stamps. We know at least about 23,000 families in the military currently are on food stamps, about 1.4 in the military currently today. A lot of that, once again, goes back to the idea that you have people coming from poverty that are joining the military to try to get out of their situation, get a better situation. That's a major, major factor. So it doesn't just go away because you join the military. Your poverty situation didn't just evaporate. It might be more more livable for the veteran or for the service member himself. But if that part he or she is married, they have a family to support on top of that.
What impact does that have if someone joins the military because they're having a problem eating? That's not a good thing.
It's not a good thing, but unfortunately, that's a real thing across the country, especially in rural
and
it used to be even a thing in the inner city. I mean, if you go back 20 years ago, but for a lot of different reasons, you're seeing a lot less African Americans and also people of color joining the military. So you don't see it as much as in the inner city as you do in rural America still.
Is that right?
That's true. That's very true. Now the thing is that we have structural problems with the way our economy is built and where our economy mm-hmm. works. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, you have certain towns, for example, that have gone through transitions where they were booming economies maybe 50, 60 years ago mm-hmm. that today are not as thriving because the economy has changed.
Yeah.
Manufacturing industry has gone down, for example. You know, so we have a lot of jobs in certain pockets of the country, but we don't have those jobs everywhere across the country. And it's not always that easy just to pack up your stuff and move to a place where there's more employment. So a lot of military bases and a lot of in the South in certain areas, they become the main support mechanism for jobs and job creation. They basically are the people that are doing most of the hiring. For Jackson, South Carolina, you got, you know, the Anderson Army Depot. You know, you got, Fort Benning, Georgia. Yeah. All these places where you have, you know, low standards of living, mm-hmm. not a lot of other economic development going on. The military mm-hmm. base is the economic development that's going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Yeah. So they're joining the military to get a good job and also maybe get education and try to improve their lives.
Sean Claiborne is with us, Vice President of Wayne Hummer Investments. And, of course, he is with the America's Heroes Group, and we're so pleased to have him. If you have a call-in number, we have a call-in number, rather, you can call us at 312-374-8130. This is something, Sean, that I really wanted to ask you about. You're giving us – it's not a good picture here. In 2017, a bill was introduced, I'm sure you know, in the House of Representatives to address the food assistance needs, but it was never brought to a vote. Now, the second bill named the Military Family Basic Needs Allowance made it through the House, but it was never even called for a vote in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
How can they do that?
Right. Well, this goes back, and it's not just, there's actually a group called the National Military Family Association. They're worth mentioning because they're the ones that actually champion this and to get this to the House and Senate. There've been a lot of bills have actually been brought to Congress to try to address this issue. The big thing is we need to start thinking about really taking a real comprehensive look as to what types of services that our veterans are actually working for. Because keep in mind, veterans have put their time in and actually have worked and earned certain benefits and things that, mm-hmm. that they deserve from the time that they've left the military till they take their last breath. People in the military are serving right now. They're putting in their time and they have earned and worked for the right to have certain types of benefits that they assume they were going to get, and the American public in general assumes that they're getting, mm-hmm. that they're not getting. And that's the problem. So we need to start to take a step back and say, hey, wait a minute. So why would you have somebody join the military and they got to pay for the uniform, they got to pay for their own food, they got to pay for this, pay for that, and they're getting basically, if you add up all the hours that they're working and looking at all the money that they're actually getting, they could have got a job at Jiffy Lube or got a job at, you know, at Walmart and made just as much money or more money. Mm-hmm. You know, when you actually look and do the math at how much time and effort, and then, oh, yeah, by the way, this is a job that might cost you your life. This is a job that might cost you your health. This is a job that may not be the same after you come back from deployment because mm-hmm. of these types of issues and things like that.
Sure.
You know, now keep in mind, like I said, there's a lot of things people can apply for. The veterans or service members need to be aware of. Most service members are aware of the fact that they can apply for like cost of living adjustments for our allowances that take into consideration where you live around the country. So to make sure that the goal is that every service member should be paid at least 130% of the poverty line, so be above 30% above the poverty line of whatever area that they are stationed in.
Okay.
So they have to apply for that. It's not automatic. So that's one thing. If you don't know about that, you need to talk to your administrative NCO, sit down and make sure you apply for that type of benefit. Most people know about the basic housing allowances and things like that, the basic assistance allowance. There's also an allowance for family members. So there's a family subsistence allowance that you can apply for as well that will help you get some money for, you know, helping taking care of your family and things like that. But these are not automatic. And sometimes they don't always stretch as well as we would like them to, mm-hmm. you know, especially in a certain situation. So,
Yeah, I've been on post where I've seen some housing that, wow, you know.
Yeah.
It's not something that a lot of people would want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is an unfortunate thing. So I guess one of the things there would be, I just say in that 2017 bill that you just mentioned, military family basic needs allowance, how can it make it through the House but never even be called in the Senate?
Well, you have is right now. There's a lot of political shenanigans or games or whatever that's going on, I think, in the House and Senate. So things are being presented in the House that but it has a Democratic stamp on it, it's probably not going to get through the Senate because it's mostly Republican in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So vice versa. That's my take on it. I think pretty much, once again, this goes back to there's too much games being played in our Congress and in the White House instead of actually sitting down and saying, hey, let's solve some problems. Let's actually take care of this and do something what we need to do. I honestly firmly believe in the fact that once you put on a uniform, you should have your food, your housing, all the things that will be stresses on you to do your job, to go out and defend this country, mm-hmm. should not be stresses for you. They should be taken away because you have enough on your plate dealing with the fact of serving this country and defending this nation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's the first thing. So you shouldn't have to worry about when you leave the military what your health care is going to be. You have to apply and prove that you did this and did that, or you were exposed to this or exposed to that. It should be automatic. You get 100% health care once you leave the military, period, because you are making the ultimate sacrifice to join the military. It's sad. You have firemen and police officers that get way better pensions and way better health care than what military service members get, and they're basically signing up to put their lives on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that's first thing we have to get and understand across the country, particularly our civilian people in our country, because they aren't realizing that this is not how the military. This is how the military actually works. They think. Just like you see in the movies or see on TV, your benefits are out the door. You got all. You're lucky because you're in the military. I hear that all the time. Are you lucky because you're in the military? They take care of you and you do all these great things for you, things like that. Right. But it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, they do think that. We are pleased to have Sean Claiborne with us, who, of course, is one of our members of America's Heroes Group and an expert on finance. And if you have a question or comment, 312-374-8130 is the number. I just wonder, too, that today was the end of our longest war.
Mm-hmm.
That's coincidental.
Yeah.
Yeah, today was the longest war. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens relative to what goes on now. The United States, as I was mentioning, is approaching 20 years in war, the longest in recorded history, and which just ended, which is a good thing. So what do you see? Our servicemen and women, Sean, willingly carry unavoidable stresses because of their commitment to serve the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's time that we take being able to feed their families off their shoulders.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that just sounds so damn obvious.
Right, because people don't. When you deploy a soldier, you're not just deploying that person; you're deploying the family along with it.
Yeah.
So that family is going along with the ride and suffering a lot of stresses.
Right.
You know that shouldn't have to be. Shouldn't be on their plate. The spouse of a service member, whether they're male or female, spouse of a service member is going through a lot of sacrifice because sometimes, once again, they have to sacrifice even their careers in order to be with someone who's in the military. Because if you can't if you don't even know how long you're going to be in any geographic area, how can you make plans and say, okay, I'm going to get this great job and have this great career when you might be there 2 years, 6 months, 2 weeks, whatever.
True. Let's take a call for Sean. Sean is with us. Sean, hi. You're on WVON, America's Heroes Group.
Hey, Cliff, how you doing?
I'm fine, Sean. Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Sean Claiborne. It's Sean Gowder. How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Great, Sean Gowder.
All right. You know, I'm so grateful for you two gentlemen for recognizing the veterans and particularly keeping the black veterans informed to the different options that we have. Cliff Kelly, Sean Claiborne has helped me a whole lot financially with everything that he says on your show. I'm a testament that what he's saying is true. And I met him because of you and the Veterans Show.
Great.
So you all keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate you both. And, Sean, let's make some money, brother. Love you.
I appreciate that. I appreciate your faith. And also appreciate your service as well.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, well, that's why we are so pleased to have America's Heroes Group, because, of course, this brilliant gentleman is one of our regular panelists, and he certainly knows how, whenever he starts talking, I start listening.
It's sad because, like I said, there's a lot of things that are going on in the world that, the mainstream media doesn't really, talk about. And you can kind of pick things out of YouTube or pick things out online. Mm-hmm. Food stamps is like a $60 billion expense on the balance sheet of the federal government. It's about $60 billion, roughly. It's been as high as about $70 billion, roughly, and then now it's about $60 billion with all the cuts they've been doing. They're talking about maybe 700,000 families being affected, or 700,000 people being affected at least for these new cuts that are happening. They've already happened, actually, where they're trying to tighten up the bolts on people that are what's mm-hmm. called able-bodied individuals, or ABODs, as the government calls them now.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that's also that's important to take note is the fact that you have inflation in food prices. Inflation in food prices, but food stamps and things, and even wages haven't kept pace with inflation of food prices. So if you're starting to cut benefits or not increasing benefits to even keep up with inflation,
mm-hmm.
that's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what we really need to do is stop talking about worrying about these different these things that divide us, and actually start looking at ways to try to empower people and empower economies in local and rural areas, particularly. Because right now we're kind of favoring certain parts and pockets of the economy that we're complaining about, these stereotypes that we have about people that are taking advantage of the system and things like that, which on a low level, very small level, does occur. But, you're punishing maybe, for every one person that's maybe taking advantage of the system, you're probably punishing 10. I'm just throwing that. I'm just using that as a round number. It's hard to support that. But that's probably what you're really seeing. When you go to the store and you have guy that asks you for money to go buy stuff at the Home Depot and trade his link card at the Walmart or the grocery store, mm-hmm. there's not 10 families doing that. There's one guy or two guys, mm-hmm. maybe once every now and again. There's not a dozen families taking advantage of, the system that you see all the time. Yeah, there's some people that could be doing more for themselves. Maybe some people have some obstacles in their way. They have either, particularly if you have any kind of issues with law enforcement, mm-hmm. or if you've been involved with the criminal justice system at all,
sure.
Or those types of records will prohibit you from getting a meaningful employment a lot of times. So it's hard to get back on your feet when you've been in jail for 10 years or 5 years or whatever, or have any mm-hmm. kind of record.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of issues are things we need to address and talk about, because that becomes dead weight to the economy. When you have someone who's not being productive, it is dead weight to the economy because they're not doing anything to help society, and they're actually sometimes bring society down. They may have to go back to crime or return to crime because they don't see any other way. It's not an excuse to go back to crime, mm-hmm. but that's the fortunate consequence of not taking care of opportunities. See, the idea of that Ronald Reagan talked about, having the shining hill in the city, or the 1,000 points of light that George Bush talked about.
Yeah.
The whole American concept is that we would provide enough resources and tools, because not because that you were born a certain race or had a certain skin color or whatever, but because you're American, that those things will be available to you.
You're great, sir. I appreciate your brilliance, Glenn Shaborn.
My pleasure. All right. Do what I can.